Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, be with us this evening. Help us to rest forever in your blissful presence, knowing you are always with us. Today is an interesting class. We went from an entire class on contentment and an entire class on kindness, and now we have fear, nervousness, non-competition, concentration, and willpower all in the 1 hour. So, so this may feel faster, but on the other hand, I think we'll find there's a really nice connection and progression through all of them, and so. Amra is going to take the first couple.
So I had a lot of good experiences getting ready for this class. Well, it's interesting because I'm not so used to doing classes, but I love to help people. So one of the main things is to not think about yourself and think about helping other people and getting calm in the heart. So as I'll just use getting ready for this class as an example of this. I'm sometimes not the best preparer, but over many, many years of studying these teachings, I find that you can apply everything that we've learned. Many of us, all of us here have been to classes, and even if this is your first class, you've been to several classes, and everything applies. So spending time just recognizing if you're getting nervous in your heart or if your heart is feeling tight, just taking deep breaths, consciously relaxing, and that expands into a feeling of love and joy instead of feeling of tightness and being concerned about yourself. So I highly recommend that. The body is usually not the reason for the nervousness. It's either from this lifetime or other lifetimes going down the wrong track or losing track of your connection with God, because we have been eternally promised that we have everything we need and we have God's love eternally. If we forget that, then that's when nervousness or fear, worse yet, can come in. So the first key is that nervousness is a mental uneasiness, and that the answer to this is calming the heart's feelings. Another thing that I've worked with a lot is our affirmations, and if anyone hasn't seen this little gem of a book, it's wonderful. Several affirmations in here. I looked first for fear, and Swami does not have fear in here. He has all of the positive qualities. The first one that I looked up was calmness, because of calmness in the heart. And through the winds of though the winds of difficulties howl around me, I stand forever calmly at the center of life's storms. And that is so powerful, just to know that no matter what happens, we can just stand in the center and be connected with God. Another key is a sense of humor. Oftentimes, if I'm having an experience and I'm realizing I'm losing my connection with my center, with God, and Asha does this a lot, and Swami does it too, you can kind of hear your voice when it's taking a wrong turn, and then you think, oh, I want that. I love that. Please give me that ice cream, or whatever it is that you hear your voice repeating. You can just step back and say, this is really pretty funny. It's kind of like a comical experience when you lose your connection, and we're just doing the best that we can, but it's pretty funny if you look back at it. a friend of mine who used to be at East West, and she had a position of a lot of responsibility. So Christmas time comes, and we're busy receiving, ordering, and it was back in the days where you could hardly keep inventory on the shelves. So we were really pressed to make sure we had enough of everything, and not only did we need to have enough of everything, but we didn't have enough money to buy everything. So there was just really a tight line. And I think it was on Christmas Day, she was walking around filled with joy saying, "I'm incompetent. I'm incompetent." And that was just wonderful. She had just had a conversation with Asha, and she realized that she was not in charge. She was not in control of even the assignments that she had been given, that really we're all incompetent. And if we think that we're better than we are, that's when, not that we're not good. Of course, we're all perfect in our soul. But when we think that we should be behaving differently than we are, or that we should be meditating more than we do, or that we should be doing something more than what we are, it's really the ego saying, "I'm really pretty good, but this is just really, you know, I'm having a bad week," or whatever. It's freeing to know, well, really, we are incompetent. We can't be in control of everything because it's not ours to do. And I've thought about that over the years when, you know, things pile up. It's like, oh, I'm incompetent. God is in charge. I'm not in charge. I'm going to do the best that I can. And Asha has another one. If I could have done better, I would have done better. And she's done a whole Sunday service on that. Even when we do things that are clearly the wrong thing to do, we're doing it because we think it's going to bring us happiness or pleasure. When our hearts get confused about what is actually going to bring us happiness and joy, but we think what's going to bring us happiness and joy is because we're a little bit confused. So we go down the wrong road, and I've kind of lost track here, but we go down the wrong road and we realize, oh, I've just made a huge mess of this. And you can become self-conscious or upset and sad that, oh, I just really used to be able to do it better. Why can't I do it better now? Well, it's the little tricks of the ego getting a hold of us. It's much easier just to be humble and say, I'm going to do the best that I can. So any time that we've started to go down that road of losing our connection and thinking that we should be better than what we are, we know, well, let's just meditate a little bit and just go back to loving God and asking God for help. I found an interesting thing about nervousness, and that it can actually be a tool for us instead of being something that we always have to overcome, because when we feel nervousness in our heart, it may be because we're actually going the wrong direction, that we're not going in the direction that's going to bring us closer to God. And I wrote down a line out of the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. Even to be mentally in tune with the guru can help you to understand every time you come to a point where you might make a mistake, what you will feel is a certain nervousness in the heart's feelings. When you are doing right, on the other hand, you will feel in your heart the guru's calm inner endorsement and approval. So instead of trying to think that we need to really overcome all nervousness, that's just an observation. If you're feeling nervous, you can take a moment to pray inwardly. If you can't do it outwardly, just get that connection to your higher self, whatever that is. If it's God, if it's Guru, if it's Mary, Jesus, just say, what is the right next step for me to take? And that alone can bring calmness in the heart. and the simple techniques of breathing through tension, and practicing when you're not having tension is a really good thing too. So yoga, postures, breathing techniques, all the meditation techniques, of course, of this path. And I found over the years, I haven't been actively teaching yoga now, but over the years of doing deep breathing through yoga, it can change your whole being. Really, yoga and the breathing techniques were created to help us to be able to calm the feelings of the body and the mind so that we could meditate more deeply. So I highly suggest just doing some deep breathing, and when you're not in a position of feeling fear or nervousness. And so Swami says that the fear is like concentrated nervousness. It's worse than nervousness. And I think of it as sometimes we don't even know why we're afraid, and we can't remember all of our past lives, of course, so we don't know exactly what's happened to cause these things. And luckily, we don't have to solve all these problems. We can practice these teachings and just offering ourselves in service instead of thinking of ourselves. If you're afraid of failure or of things, you're hoping things will go a certain way at work, and you know you're doing your best you can to work towards that, but knowing that thinking of what it is you can offer in the situation instead of what it is that you hope and dream is going to happen, what it is you can give in any situation, even if it's many of the things that we've been practicing in these classes, being friendly to a stranger or whatever it is that you can offer. Once you start to offer instead of feeling like you need something coming in, then that's going in the right direction. A fear of the future, there's can be a lot of that happening right now, and it's good to prepare, of course, and the best preparation is what we're doing here today and what we do in our own spiritual practice. So that's definitely the best preparation for feeling fear of the future. But of course, we need to be practical and do the best we can to prepare on all levels, not only spiritually. There's a prayer that many of us have known about, and it's called the Peace and Harmony Prayer. So if mostly I see it as working in my personal practice, mostly what I've done is use that as a with individuals, but it could also be used in a situation. If there's any difficulty with a person, if there's been misunderstanding, it could be someone that you know or someone that you don't know that well. How many people here have heard of the Peace and Harmony Prayer? So most people. It's a gem. So you can take a person, and if you're feeling angry, upset, sad, whatever you're feeling with a person, you can offer that to God by saying, Divine Mother, fill Amara with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. And you repeat that several times. I think it's for 1 minute. Divine Mother, fill Amara with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. And as you're doing that, closing the eyes, and you feel your heart expanding, and also you feel it's true, you want that person to be filled with peace and harmony. And you do that, and then after that, after 1 minute, you say for yourself, I'll use the same name, but Divine Mother, fill me with peace and harmony for 10 seconds. If you do this 3 or 4 times a day, it is miraculous, really. And I've done it more than 2 or 3 times a day. And it's almost instantaneous, where difficult situations that maybe have built up even over years dissolved really quickly. So that's a great one. And it's so simple. Divine Mother, fill whoever with peace and harmony, peace and harmony. And so fear, I think the biggest way that it's an obstacle to success is the contraction that's involved with it. If any of you have been in any of the chakras classes, fear is the negative aspect of the first chakra, which is the earth element. The positive aspect of the first chakra is loyalty. So it's something that's really strong and solid. And when the energy is going inward to the self and downward in a negative feeling, then it's deep contraction. So what we need to do, obviously, is try to have the opposite happening. So you can remedy these things by practicing a loyalty and a deep friendship. Even though it's maybe not exactly directed toward your difficulty that you're feeling fear about, the beauty of these teachings is you can just, in your life, express the opposite of that quality in some way, and it frees up that energy. So the energy is just energy. It's not necessarily, it's not personal, really, and it's not specific. So energy is just energy. If you're feeling contraction and fear, you can practice the opposite of that, which is a sharing and being a loyal friend, being loyal to even Chidambar's an amazing example of loyalty, where he likes to be even loyal to a restaurant or a place where he gets his oil changed. You know, he's not going to just go to another place simply because there's a $5 coupon or something. So energy is just energy, and you can change it by doing the opposite, by doing these practices. You can also change it by, your body can change energy, or your body, holding your body in a certain way can create energy. Moving it can loosen that energy. So that's another way where yoga postures are incredible, because you don't have to be working on a specific difficulty, but the movement of energy through practicing yoga changes that energy and transforms that energy without it having to be specific. And always keep asking and inwardly praying, is this the right choice? Is this the right direction? And there's just such a freeing feeling when you offer yourself in your morning meditation, or as often as you think of it, to be in God's flow, because it's much more fun. But once you make that a habit in your life, then the energy, you become more intuitive, and you find what God is wanting you to do, which is always for our highest good. You may have heard this in this class, but I love it. It's from Yogananda. I will, I will reason, I will act, but guide my reason, will, and activity in the right thing in all that I do. That's not an exact quote, but of course we have to act, and of course we have to, like Tandava said to Reba, you're responsible, you've been assigned this to work out this difficulty, but we can ask for God's guidance and do our very best. And doing your very best is always relaxing in the heart, even if your best is not that good. Swami's mother, I think it was, said, if there's something that's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. And I don't know if he gave the background to that, but she was a musician. I believe it was a violin. And she had an injury where her fingers were cut, and she could no longer utilize them like she did. But she was a beautiful musician. And she decided she was going to be a musician anyway, even though it wasn't the best. It was worthwhile doing, and it was worthwhile doing badly, even if that's the best she could do. So I thought we could do one of the activities together. So just sit up straight and take a deep breath and relax the body. And as you breathe, feeling the heart expanding, the chest relaxing and expanding with the breath. Let's just take 2 or 3 full breaths. And now concentrate on the heart. Calm the feelings there. Continue to inhale and breathe deeply. Drawing all the energy from the lower spine toward the heart. Now imagine your heart as a lotus. Direct the petals of this lotus upward to the brain. Feel the energy flowing from those petals up past the throat chakra, past the medulla at the base of the skull, and flowing on until it becomes centered in the point between the eyebrows. Feel supreme contentment in the flow of energy rising from all points of the body and becoming centered at that point, the Christ Center, as Yogananda called it. Now, I realize that I just led you through last week's exercise, so it was good anyway. We can either do another one now or do one at the end, maybe. What do you think, Tandava? It's 8:05. Okay, let's go ahead and do one. Let's do another one. Yeah, it was. You can't go wrong with contentment. Okay, so we'll do one on nervousness. Picture to yourself some situation that normally would make you nervous. Next, center yourself inwardly with a straight spine. Then concentrate on calming your heart's feelings. Inhale and exhale deeply, calming the heartbeat. Then imagine voluntarily entering into that situation. Now then, see yourself facing it calmly. Then finally, make it a point actually to enter either that situation or else one very like it and maintain a calm center pose. And I'll just end with a few thoughts that we can't change the past, so we can't change the past, we can't go back and change the past. Part of the Festival of Light that we listen to every Sunday, if you come to Sunday service, this is always a thrill to me to hear, and I've experienced it, I'm sure all of you have also. A little practice of this inward religion will free one from dire fears and colossal suffering. So that is such a joy to know and to experience it ongoing. And what I mentioned earlier, the only thing that we really need, no matter what, has already been eternally promised to us, and that is God's eternal love.
If you ever have to get up and speak in front of a group of people, get Amra to lead you through a meditation right beforehand. It's a good way to do it. So, our segue between topics here is going to be our old buddy, the ego, because fear comes from basically having an ego in the first place, because the thought that we are this one specific body, this entity here that is separate from all these other entities, means that those things out there can hurt us over here in some way, whether it's physical or emotional or whatever way. And we talked, you know, a few classes ago about the ego and just trying to expand it and how that changes your experience of life, including the more expanded your ego is, the more things sort of are you, in a sense, however you want to think about that. And you know, the reasons the masters on the wall have no fear of anything is because they've identified with all of creation. You know, and if you're identified with all of creation, well, what is out there that's going to hurt you? You know, it's all just another part of you. Fear can be a little bit overwhelming, though, and sometimes it's a very hard one to get a handle on and actually deal with. The next topic in the lesson is non-competitiveness, which is kind of a lower octave of it, because, again, it's this ego-based thing, competition. There's me here, there's you there, and we're at odds in some sense. But it's a little more manageable if you need something to work on and you can't quite deal with some of your fears. This is maybe a level you can tackle. And this is something that you can think about mentally only. It doesn't mean that you automatically remove yourself from every competitive situation, because a lot of the times we're simply in things that are in some sense competitive. But even if you need to be there, you don't have to think in a competitive way. You don't have to feel competitive. And one of my favorite examples is I work at East West Bookshop, and across the street are two more bookshops. Literally across from us is Book Buyers, next door to them is Books, Inc. And, you know, it's not an easy time to be a bookshop these days. I mean, all of Borders went out of business a year or two ago, you know, and they're one of those big guys that all those little guys are afraid of getting squashed by, and they, you know, collapsed. You know, what are we to do? But I love it because there's three of us literally on the same block. You know, we can throw a rock and hit each other, and we're doing fine. And we don't have a competitive attitude. It's not like we're always running ad campaigns to drag customers away from them. But we're cooperating. We all kind of have our own little niche. If somebody needs a book that's out of print, we send them to Book Buyers to go look for it. If they need the latest thriller, we send them to Books, Inc. You know, if they want some obscure book about yoga, people send them over to us. And everything works. And it's just beautiful. And so anybody who tells you that to get ahead in business, you have to squelch the competition. No, not really. There are a lot of ways to be a success, even with other people trying to be a success in the same or similar way. And of course, this concept isn't only about literal competitions, but more broadly in any sense of comparison. Because even if you're just sort of weighing one thing against another, it becomes kind of a competition, even if only inside, right? Swami uses the phrase, don't cut off someone's head to make yourself look taller. You know, and you know, metaphorically, don't belittle anyone. Don't try and puff yourself up. And, you know, have an attitude of humility. But also, he clarifies humility by saying, don't pretend to false humility. Don't overdo it. True humility is seeing things exactly as they are, neither better nor worse. And this ties in all the way back to our first class. Remember what the first class was? Honesty, truthfulness, integrity, seeing things as they actually are. And if you are very good at something, well, you honestly just are very good at something, and it's not boastful to admit it. If you're a singer and you get up on stage at Sunday service and you sing a song and people compliment you on it, you know, don't just go, oh, no, it was horrible, I messed up. Because maybe you really did sing a nice song. Even if you knew there were mistakes, somebody enjoyed it enough to compliment you. And so there are a couple things here. You're just being honest and having clear perception and acknowledging the truth of a situation. And you're also being kind to the person who gave you a nice compliment. I mean, somebody says something nice to you and you tell them they have bad judgment. That's not really fair play, you know. But, you know, you also don't, the humble part is involved on the other end then by not taking it as, well, yes, that's because I'm awesome and you're not. You know, don't go that direction either. Just acknowledge it and accept the compliment and everybody's happy. One of my favorite responses is something along the lines of, thank you, I had a great time too. Because if it did go well, then, you know, it probably was fun. And even if I thought it was horrible and I could have done a lot better, well, I can thank them for the compliment because it was awfully nice of them to say it, you know. And it's all true, and it's not putting yourself down or putting yourself up. It's just as things are. So humility is more self-forgetfulness even than anything else. Because if it was somebody else, you would just acknowledge, like, yes, they did an excellent job. Or, hey, it could have been better. Well, whatever. No big deal. But when it's us, when we're thinking about ourselves, that's when we get into all our weird complexes of blowing it up or shrinking it down or whatever, and it's just a mess. But in a similar vein, in terms of seeing things as they are, Swami also cautions against taking humility too far and to have discrimination in about whatever circumstance you're in. So for instance, if somebody is treating you sort of badly or insults you or something like that, it may be a good exercise for you to just take it and just go, okay, and not, in practice, just not letting it get to you, because most people are wrong about most things, so what does it really matter what anybody says? And, you know, it's just the ego, and the ego can take a few hits, who cares? But on the other hand, that's not license to always just be a doormat. And it's important to, again, have clear-seeing discrimination and say, no, this particular situation may actually be something that I need to stand up for because somebody's trying to do something that is really inappropriate. And it is the better dharma to stop that, not from a sense of protecting my ego, but from a sense of, like, this is wrong and you just need to stop doing this. The classic example is from the Bhagavad Gita, and Arjuna, on the eve of battle, gets cold feet. And he says, these are my cousins, I can't go out and fight them. And so much of the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna explaining that when a duty conflicts with a higher duty, it ceases to be a duty. Yes, it is ordinarily wrong to go fight your cousins, but they have done a very wrong thing. It needs to be reversed. In the allegorical sense, we need to drive out delusion and reestablish soul consciousness in the kingdom. These are higher duties, and it's important to recognize that and go, okay, I'm not doing this for any egoic reason. I'm doing it because it is important and it needs to be done, and that's the situation God put me in. And so there you see that there's not an attitude of competitiveness in there. I mean, in the Bhagavad Gita, we're talking about a war, but it's not about me beating them. It's about this situation is not dharmic, it's not appropriate. We need to change the situation. Now, non-competitiveness leads to the next concept of concentration. And I think of it in that if you're not always thinking what other people are doing and how you relate to them and how you're going to react to what they do, well, there's all that energy that you are spending worrying about that you can pull back in and concentrate on whatever you actually are trying to do and just do the best job that you can. So it's sort of like non-competitiveness with yourself. You know, it's just focusing all your energies and you don't have these conflicting things inside yourself to deal with. Competition for some people can seem to increase concentration, basically because they probably needed a motivation to concentrate on whatever it was, and competition for some people gives them some motivation. It's sort of a low level of motivation, perhaps, but sometimes you gotta just use whatever works to get people going. But it's something that, if that's where you are, is worth rising above, because the competition is ego-bound and therefore inherently limited in how much you can do with it. Whereas non-competition is potentially limitless. And also better karmically, because you're not putting... Remember we talked about karma in one of the discussions recently? You know, you can be doing the exact same thing as somebody else, but with a different feeling behind it, a different consciousness behind it. You can be in the same situation, but with a competitive attitude, you're putting out a let's work against each other sort of attitude, which is eventually going to come back and hit you. Whereas if you just pull back from that and concentrate, you're putting out a much better kind of karmic energy. And then what you can do when you're not putting all that energy into worrying about other people and reacting to that, is you can concentrate in a much more relaxed way without strain. Concentration, Swami defines as total absorption, which has a very different feeling. Like, we think of this mental energy and straining and really working hard, but absorption, it's just this wonderful word. You just feel yourself soaking up into a sponge, and you go, whoop, and then you're just there. It's like he compares it to being in love. You don't have to remind yourself to think about your sweetheart. You know, if you're actually in love, you're probably doing it all the time, and you're probably enjoying it, and it's probably not a lot of work. And we can actually develop that sort of concentration in every aspect of our lives. And if you get really involved in a project or something, you'll find the same kind of thing happening. It just, you naturally get sucked into it. There's sort of like that absorption word again, sucked into it. And it just fills your consciousness, and that's what's there. I had a very funny thing happen. This must have been 12, 13 years ago. I still remember it because it's just a little ridiculous. Mac OS 10 had just come out. If you remember how different that was from Mac OS 9, okay, so I was spending a long time getting everything working, making sure all my old apps are still working or reinstalling things or whatever, and I was just spending way too long on it. But I was totally involved in it, and it was cool technology, so I was having fun. Finally, I took a break and went to go play my violin just for a change. Started opening the violin case, and literally the first thing I thought was, I wonder if this will open in class or if I have to reinstall my violin. So that was being absorbed in it, which has the side lesson of it's worth paying attention what you concentrate on, because if you really concentrate properly, it will fill out a lot of the rest of your life. And that's why meditation is one of the best ways to practice concentration. For one, because true meditation is not the Hong Sa technique or this mantra or that breath work or whatever. True meditation is the point that all that gets you to, which is concentration on God. And the way that we describe it is trying to be absorbed into a sense of oneness with God or any of God's attributes, love, joy, energy, etc. So if you practice your concentration that way, that's a really good thing to have seeping into everything else in your life. But really, meditation is the practice we have that is the most, it's just the most pure practice of concentration. It's like lifting weights for your mind. You know, lifting weights isn't doing anything except developing that muscle. Meditation helps you really develop that concentration muscle. And the way we teach it here, you know, you focus here. Master said this is the point of concentration in your body right here, which is why people wrinkle up their brows sometime when they're concentrating. Though again, we're going to try and do this nice and relaxed. But you know, meditate, focus here as much as you can, and that's very good practice. Swami also gives a couple of the exercises that you'll practice this week, hopefully. And you'll notice he takes it from two different angles. He has the one exercise about concentrating on something, But he also has another exercise very specifically about blocking out everything else that you're not concentrated on. Because we're really, it's such a useful skill because we're just bombarded with things all around us. You know, everywhere you go, advertising, music, noises, people of all sorts of different consciousness that you may or may not want to absorb. And it's worth being able to, you know, say, I want this, and I don't want that in my consciousness. And I mean, sometimes we don't even notice it. I mean, we're so used to it, but it just has effects. Another amusing story, I was in college. I was trying to read what was probably, admittedly, a fairly boring book. But anyway, I was down in the dorm lounge, and somebody was playing the piano. And I thought, okay, it'll be nice. I can at least listen to piano playing while I'm reading. And they were practicing something, and they got to a hard bit, and they played the same two measures over and over about 5 times. And I finally realized that I had read the same line 5 times. I didn't think I was listening to them until I realized that I was just going ka-chunk, ka-chunk, right in time with them. It was, wow. So it's a good practice to be able to not only concentrate there, but block that out. And then, of course, the more we develop concentration, the more it's going to enhance everything we do. I mean, I don't think we have to argue that point too much, because probably anything in your life you can think of, you can imagine it being better if you could concentrate more perfectly on it. But more specifically, is how concentration relates to willpower, which is the last, finally, topic for tonight, of all 5 of our topics tonight. Willpower is defined as desire for something plus energy directed towards fulfilling that desire. And so concentration fills in there with concentrated energy. And it's an interesting equation, because you can see that increasing your desire will increase your willpower, and increasing your concentration will increase your willpower. These things will all sort of feed back into each other, which is a good thing to remember. You know, if you're trying to find more willpower. But an important part to add to this equation, or clarification really, is similar to concentration. We don't want to do it with strain. We want to be relaxed about everything we do. When I was first learning to be a musician, well, and still even, I always enjoyed watching other very, very good musicians just to try and see what I could absorb from them. And what I noticed across so many very, very good musicians is they all made it look easy. That's the way I put it back then. But it's because they stay very relaxed. One of my favorite experiences of this was again in college, and I went to just this free noon concert thing. It was a recital of a bunch of piano students, and under one particular piano teacher. And these were all people who had been playing since they were 4 years old or something. So they're in the 99th percentile of piano players in the world. They're all very, very good. And it was great. I love the music. I probably didn't hear a wrong note anywhere. They were superb. The last person was sick, couldn't come. So the teacher, Fred Weldy, just says, well, we got a few minutes. I'll play you something. He sits down, whips out Aaron Copland's Jazz Suite, I think it was, starts playing, and I relaxed in a way that I had not realized I was tense before. There was just this sense that, oh, well, this is different. The other people didn't make any mistakes, but there's the possibility that they could. He was so relaxed, it just filled the room and just went, okay, we can really just enjoy this now. And listening to a CD, you don't expect the CD to make a mistake. You know? And it was amazing when somebody is that, and you could tell just watching him, he was just happy, just in this flow, and it was fantastic because he was so relaxed. It could just come through him that way. If you get tense, a good way to deal with that is think not so much in terms of willpower, which feels tense, power, strength, but think in terms of willingness. And actually, now that I think about this sort of relates back to concentration and being in love. You know, you just want to be. You're perfectly happy to do it, so it's not work at all. The more willing you are to do something, the more easy it is to generate willpower. Sometimes we don't feel very willing to do whatever we have to do. But there's some tricks, one of which is to act like you're willing. we can fool ourselves a surprising amount. It's a little embarrassing how badly we can fool ourselves sometimes. But if you act happy to do something, willing to do something, it actually gets kind of easier. So it's totally worth trying. You can also focus on your motivation for whatever it is that you're doing. So we said willpower is desire plus the energy towards it. So there's desire, that's your motivation. And sometimes you just have to zoom out a little bit. You know, I am, you know, working this job so that I can make the money to put my kid through college. You know, just remind yourself, you know, a step or two back up the ladder why this is happening. And as a last resort, motivation, if nothing else really works, I like to just remember, you know, karma is exact, so God put me here for a reason. And so if I can't see any other reason, you know, there's the fact that I am here, I have been given this job to do, so I darn well better do it. Because karma doesn't go away if you pretend it's not yours. Swami recommends in the exercises picking a task, setting all your will to it, and doing it. Pretty straightforward. It's good to pick an appropriate level. You know, don't climb Everest on your first try. But it allows for some creativity, you know, figuring out what can I do. You know, if you need to cut back on sugar in your diet, don't go cold turkey on day one, maybe. I've had a lot of luck telling myself I will eat sweets on the weekend because it's really hard for me to go cold turkey on the sweets. But if I say, you know, I can eat that on Saturday, it'll be fine. And they don't keep it in the house. That also helps. But then it's a little easier to hang on today if I know I can just eat it on Saturday. And it's still better than eating anything I want 7 days a week. And then if that goes a little well, then you can say, okay, not just weekends, but maybe only Saturdays. And I have 1 day a week. Then maybe only every other Saturday. And then you can work up to it, and then you just build it like a muscle. The Amra quoted some things from the Affirmations book, and I had actually written down a few things here as well, because it's a fantastic book, and if you don't have it, you should. But about willpower, he says, willpower, and not the vague abstraction luck, is the secret of true achievement. Willpower on subtle energy levels generates what only looks like luck by magnetically attracting to us opportunities. And that's sort of a little teaser for next week when the topic is magnetism. Everything ties together. It's really beautiful how you start seeing the connections between all these different topics throughout the course. But anyway, that is my story, and I'm sticking to it. And we can circle up now, I think, and reform. Now, do I have any questions or comments or revelations?
Just on the Peace and Harmony prayer, Master actually says, if you do it 5 times, it cannot fail.
5 times a day.
A day.
Yeah. And it's for a minute and 15 seconds on the two parts each time. Yeah. So you have the avatar guarantee on that. Give it a try.
I've got a question about nishkam karma, action without desire for the result. Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear more about that.
Let's see. That's interesting because we were just talking about desire directed towards towards goals. Is this working?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's an interesting juxtaposition because we were just talking about specifically directing our energy towards our desires by the use of willpower. Nishkam karma, it takes a little mental jiggle to get into the right frame of mind for that. But it has to do with giving the action to God, giving the results to God, recognizing that you've been put in this situation. This is you have this job to do, or even you have been given this desire to fulfill, and doing your best to do whatever this task is. Because if you always do your best at everything, you're going to be putting out good energy all the time, or at least the best energy you can. So whatever it is, it may be worth doing badly, but it may also be worth doing your best. It's just that your best may be bad sometimes, but whatever. You do your best. But then to whatever extent you can, you let go of the result and just say, you know, God, I did my part, and you'll give me the result that I need or that is appropriate in this situation. And the more desire you have for a specific thing to happen, the trickier that is. But you can also go back to the fire exercise from a few classes ago. Remember that? And just practice, you know, like, God, I really want this result right now, but I know it's all up to you, so I'm just going to practice putting it in the fire, and I'm just going to keep on doing my best, you know, achieving whatever I need to achieve, but I'm going to remember that everything's up to you. And process of reminding yourself about that.
You know, if I while you're speaking, I was thinking of if I change it to action without attachment for the result. You know, we kind of went through that concept, and I kind of grasped that.
Yeah.
So this one just kind of threw me, because desire without desire for the intent, it's like, it seems like aimless action then. Yeah. But maybe it simply means like not attachment.
Yeah. I mean, a desire is an attachment.
Okay.
So if you don't have attachments, you don't have desires for it either. Okay. But you can still, again, use your discrimination and recognize what is appropriate to happen in this situation, and then act accordingly, and just trust that God will help it work out or not work out, as the case may be. So,
I guess I'm content as a person knowing that I have some non-attached desires.
Yeah. And, you know, you practice where it's easy, just like with everything else, and, you know, the big things may be a little harder to practice Nishkam Karma with, but, you know, if you're running late to work and you really want to be on time to work, but, you know, you're going to be 2 minutes late, you know, just say, you know, God, I'm just going to do my best to get there on time, but, you know, the results are in your hands, and practice where you can. Yeah.
I think just on top of everything Tandav is saying, of course, it's the truth, and I wholeheartedly agree with it, but I want to say this is really one of the highest teachings in the whole Bhagavad Gita. I mean, this is the essence, because what it means that we're saying is we understand that we are channels for divine energy to flow, and as long as we're doing the best that we can do to be open to let that energy flow, which, of course, is always a goal. So it's not a passive, there's nothing passive about this. It's a very active spiritual pursuit to have one's ego out of the way and to be in that place of knowing that it's God acting through us. And as long as we are as out of the way as we can be, really very much what Tandava was saying, then we're not as attached to the outcome, because it was never us doing it anyway, not the action. That really, these words that are always so hard to find, we say them all the time, but we can very easily get into saying them, God is the doer, God is the doer. Eventually you have to say, what does that mean, really? But it means that, like, really, that our job is to be less and less attached, to get ourselves more and more out of the way, but to be showing up with every ounce of everything we're talking about today, energy, concentration, will, so that we're doing the very best we can do from a spiritual perspective, and then let it go. Do the best you can do, let it go, do the best.
I was thinking that if I go moment by moment, and, you know, if you could look at life or this play like a frame, movie frames, and so you pause after each moment, listen for what Divine Mother says for you to do next, because she's directing the play, and you just keep going frame by frame, and each time just waiting to find out, what do I do next? And so then you can't be attached. All you're doing is waiting to hear what she wants you to do next. And it might be something totally different from what you thought. Anyway, that started to occur to me.
In addition to all that that has been said, you know, I think of Nishkam Karma related to two different things, one of which is just the concept of Dharma, where we have a certain level of responsibility in this life. I mean, Sri Yukteswar talked about this idea, and it's wildly paraphrasing, that basically we have to show gratitude if we're breathing the free air on this planet. I mean, just that very basic premise that we're here and have a responsibility. So there's so many responsibilities that come to us in a particular way. So dharma, our dharmic response is to fulfill it to the highest extent that we are capable of. Without, and then letting it go with a greater sense that God is the doer and that God will bring to us that which is ours regardless. So it's not a quid pro quo. It's not a sense that we're doing it. I want to say this in the right way. We're not doing it to get something in return, but we can't get what's ours without doing it, right? If that makes sense. So we have to give everything our best, and only under those circumstances will God truly, we can, you know, that's the way we can break through. There's this illustration we use of a circle, and that circle representing the sum total of all that's needed, let's just say in this world, 25% of it is our effort. So our lives are involving 25% of our effort. And 25% our effort draws the grace of the guru, and that then draws the grace of God. So the grace of God is 50% of the whole picture. But none of that can be set in motion unless we ourselves are giving 100% to our 25% of the picture. And you know, Nishkam Karma is just such a wonderful practice. It just, you know, it's brutal sometimes. But bit by bit I know this has taken me years to even really wanting the willingness to embrace what is mine. What is mine to do? And then to step back and accept that which comes to me as mine in addition.
This is an interesting point because I think everybody somewhere early on in the spiritual path hits this weird block about, you know, if I don't have desires, I'm just going to be this lump on the ground. You know, and I remember vividly, you know, when I hit that block and had to go through it. So it's worth paying attention to. And another key point is that our desires are not really all that good for us a lot of the time. You know, I was talking about trying to eat sweets only on weekends because I really wanted to eat all those cookies. And, you know, it would be a lot better for me if I didn't. I mean, that's pretty obvious, but I still really want to, but I have this desire not to. Like, right there, all these desires are already fighting. And so giving up desires doesn't mean you don't do anything. It means you're completely free to do the right thing in every situation, because why wouldn't you do the absolute right, best thing in every situation? The only reason is because you have desires to do other things that aren't as good. And so that can be a good way to relate to it sometimes, I think, and get a little more impersonal about some of the desires.
This is just a fun story. I think it's related. Hopefully you'll get the point. It was like a month before Swami passed, and one day on a Saturday, I said, you know, I'm just going to give myself the day off, like, you know, stop thinking and all that. And I had some errands to do, and I said, oh, I'll just walk over to California Avenue, and it'll just be so nice to see all the shop owners and such, and do this pile of errands I'd backlogged. And I walked into the first store, and it was a sweet little old woman, and I could tell she wanted to tell me her story. And so I was like, great, I've got all day, you know. So and I sat, and I could just tell she was so happy, and I was so happy, and it was great. And then I went on to the next store, and again, I was like, oh, this is such an interesting job you have to this man who was, you know, he had all day in his store. He loved having someone come in and talk, and it was so nice, and I was generally interested, like, oh, really, what else do you do? And the next thing I know, he's like, oh, you know, don't even worry about that, just take it. And this went on for a few shops, and suddenly I thought, I'm like Swami. This is like Swami flowing through me, as all the stories we hear of him in the stores in Italy and such. And it was just so beautiful, and I just enjoyed that for a minute. And it, you know, it was, and so I suppose I'll say maybe I was acting super consciously, because I didn't consciously go out to get anything. I just thought, oh, let me just, I guess, be joyful. What a concept. And so I was enjoying that. I thought, this is just so wonderful. And then something shifted. And I went, all of a sudden I thought, oh, let me go make that lady happy. So I went to the next cashier, and I was like, ah, da 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 da, just like I'd been to everybody else. And she was like, so as soon as I started being conscious of being the doer, right, I can make her happy. Watch this one, master. Here I go. Yeah, it was so cool. It was just, anyway.
Excellent example.
It made me happy.
Yeah.
There was a phrase that Swamiji uses a few times. He says, most people are wrong most of the time. He says that a couple different places. And I...
You have to wonder if he was wrong.
Okay, good. That's settled. I like that.
Are you wondering if that's actually true? Or?
Well, I just... I'm sure it's true. I just don't quite understand it.
Did you have a comment? Or just... Okay, I was going to say maybe a couple ways to take this. One is that maybe we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously either. I mean, how much do we really know? Actually, this goes back to ego. Think how many times you try to act knowledgeable about something that you really have no clue about just to participate in the conversation or something like that. But really, like, On a deep sense, how much do we know about everything? Like, if these masters came to tell us what reality is really like, how many people in this world are even paying attention to them? You know, most of us are in this room or affiliated nearby, and how much do we grasp what they're trying to tell us? You know, even us who are trying. So, really, you know, don't have too high of an opinion of your opinions or anybody else's, because what do we know? And it's helpful for just relaxing about people, you know, piling stuff on your ego. It's like, okay, they insulted me, but they could be wrong, you know. Hey, I think I'm pretty great, but I could be wrong too, you know. Don't worry about it. You want to, Mom, I think, had something?
It's a comment about being wrong. You know, I think of myself as being somebody who's, you know, right a fair amount of the time.
Because why would you be wrong?
Because,
I mean, really.
Yeah, and I think about things, and then I carefully make decisions, and then sometimes they're wrong. But every once in a while, I will get into just a period of time where I notice how often I'm wrong. And it's just like all day long, every day, I'm wrong about this, and then I'm wrong about that. And they're little things, you know, like I'm thinking, oh, there's no paper in the copier because so-and-so forgot to do his job and put it in there. Well, no, he didn't. It's because he was doing this job and something else happened or the paper didn't come. So-and-so is late for this, and I'm assuming it's because this person is once again kind of faking it, but it turns out that's the day that, you know, her mom fell and broke her leg and she had to take her to the hospital. And so she's like, oh, wrong again. And it can literally go for days. And I wonder, how do I survive being wrong as often as I am? You know, and just multiply that by a lifetime and all the people around it. Like, God is really, like, watching over us because, like, otherwise, where would we be? But that may be partly what Swami's talking about. We think we're right, but where we're operating on a completely incorrect set of assumptions that are actually something else is going on, but we have the wrong interpretation. That was just my possibly incorrect interpretation of that.
And we're getting along fine, you know? It's like Amra's friend, I am incompetent, isn't it great? You know, the pressure's off because it's still working anyway. But
I think mainly what people express are their opinions and... You know, I know that's what I do, and it's, you know, how many of us are really even aware of the concept of wisdom or attuning ourselves to it? So either, you know, something is true or it isn't. If we're aligned with wisdom, it may be true, and generally it isn't. So this is, I mean, it's like, this is what people talk about. I think this, I believe this. So I think, you know, it's a very simple statement. Most of the time, most people are wrong, and it would have to be. Talk about the masters speaking only truth because that's what they do. But very few of us are really able to reason at that level.
You know, I just said there's a saying, would you rather be right or would you rather be happy? Because it doesn't really matter if you're right or wrong. Just
most of the time it doesn't really matter, right?
As long as we're being wrong here, I'll give a follow-up to last week's talk. Remember I talked about guitar shopping. Turns out I got the wrong guitar. I mean, that's just all there was to it. I really wanted that guitar to be right. I did. I loved that guitar. It was a beautiful guitar. I had a name for it and everything. It was. I really wanted it to be the right guitar. Then it wasn't, and I was, and that's part of why I was getting the buyer's remorse. And so I went and talked to Karen because I wasn't going to be able to sort it out on my own. And Karen pointed out that it's lovely, but it doesn't. It doesn't hold up to accompanying a whole choir. It really needs a lot more oomph. And she was just absolutely right. I just couldn't do it on my own because that want of it to be right was just sort of muscling everything else out of the way. And so there's a lesson there. Ask your friends, because even if most people are wrong, well, at least you can get a few people helping you be wrong in your favorite way. Jill?
My observation.
Part of what was happening there was, with Karen's help, was gain that extra kick to let go of the want for that particular guitar, and then also thinking about the real reason. Again, we talked about thinking about the motivation. We talked about considering other people rather than ourselves. I was getting this guitar because I have so many musical duties around here, and I make so many other people listen to the guitar that I play, that it's really worth having a good one. And, you know, and so let go of all these ego things. It's not about what I want, it's about what the right thing is for this situation.
Did you return it?
I returned it, and I got a different one. Yeah, that was the one I played on Sunday.
You know, the guitar on Sunday sounded so good.
That was the new one.
It
was excellent.
I've been wanting to say it to you since. Yeah. I just kept thinking, God, he sounds great. Good decision.
So, yeah, yeah.
But what if Karen is wrong most of the time?
we're increasing our odds by having more devotees who are more trying to tune into, what's trying to happen, more trying to figure out what is the right thing to do here versus what we want to happen. You know, at least the folks in this room, you know, and the people we hang out with here at Ananda are trying to go the direction of not just dealing with your egoic wants, but really what is needed for whatever situation. And the more of us are really trying to go there, the more chance we have of going there. Most people in the world are not even trying, which gives them much less chance of getting anywhere in the neighborhood. So, yeah. And the more we practice, you know, noticing what is a desire and what is actual perception, the more we can filter things out. And again, it's a continuum. We just get better as we go along. And sometimes you get to the point like where I was at, where I realized that there was something in here that was a desire that was obscuring what was actually true, even if I couldn't quite get it out of the way, which is why I needed to have Karen come over and give it a kick for me. But again, that's just another stage along the continuum to hopefully someday just being able to set that aside and see what's there.
You were talking about getting desires out of the way and all of that, and I was thinking about it in another way, just saying, Divine Mother, what do you want me to do now? What should I do now? What should I do now? What should I do next?
Because that's not your desire. You're asking. You're dictating.
Yeah. So it's more like almost a constant prayer to her, and then waiting, praying, and then listening, praying, and listening, praying, and listening over and over and over. And the more... It's starting to occur to me that must be what I need to do anyway.
Wouldn't hurt any of us, probably. Hmm? Wouldn't hurt any of us, but you know, that's a wonderful way to... The more you can keep that up throughout your life, the more it's going to actually happen that you're tuning into there and actually following it, yeah.
Because how do I know what's dharmic? How do I know what's my karma? I don't. I can maybe in the next minute or second know what I need to do next if I've been listening to Divine Mother, but then as soon as I stop and I start having my own opinions or my own, what Chidambar was saying.
Projections.
Projections. Then I'm off somewhere else, and she's waving, no, 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 no. And then finally I listen again after some misery, and then I get back to what Divine Mother wants, and then, you know, and it's just, it seems like that's what it is. It's just pray, listen, pray, listen, pray, listen.
Yeah. I'll do it if you can keep doing it. But yeah, like you say, you have to practice, because
yeah.
You stop for a while, and then you get miserable, and then you come back and you do it again. And
yeah.
Yep. So you
and keep hopefully
working.
The recovery time will be less, like Stephen said.
Yeah.
I think that one of the it came up, I think, when Amara was speaking. You didn't say these exact words, but in terms of what you're saying, Marilyn, which is being said so. It's absolutely right and so adorable. Pray, listen, pray, listen. But it's true. But, you know, when Swamiji always said that his litmus test was if something disturbed his inner peace, so in that way we know what is dharmic or what is right. Because when something's really, when we're doing it for a higher good, it feels that way usually.
But my projections can really disturb my inner peace.
Your own projections.
Yep.
But that's your blinking red light. That's the point, is that at least we know, wait a minute, I'm not at peace. I mean, so you know, wait a minute, that's a projection of mine, which, you know, so much of what we all do is, but still, as opposed to the moments where you say, this feels really good. I know this is just the right thing, to be able to pay attention to that, because we can feel our own good guidance if we pay attention. I just wanted to say, as we're getting ready to close, I mean, if anybody else has anything to say, fine, but I keep wanting to say this at the end of every class, and I don't know why, but I'm going to say it. I did it maybe class two or so, too, is that everything that we're talking about in these classes, I mean, tonight, Tandava and Amara covered five huge areas. I mean, it was just so much, which I think, by the way, you both did so beautifully, and I really mean that, because you look at it, if you read the lessons ahead, it feels impossible. He's covering the essence of the spiritual path in 6 short weeks, you know, and I mean, 9 hours. It's just amazing that we're doing it, but that everything we're talking about, you know, concentration, willpower, competitiveness, all of these qualities. Every one is about how are we going to do better on the spiritual path. Not just how are we going to do better personally, but to realize these are ancient keys to success and happiness. And somehow I just want to keep reminding us that these are so profound, these lessons, and his genius is being able to put them into 6 weeks. But every one of these we're doing not just because they're nice things to do, not just because it feels better to be less competitive, but because we're all yogis and we're looking for ways to grow spiritually. And if we took any one of these qualities, like the lessons have us do, I mean kindness, contentment, you know, concentration, which, as Tandava said very clearly, it's the whole point of meditation. It's absolutely both a key ingredient and an endpoint in meditation, which is really what the whole path is about and how to get where we're going. So I just wanted to say out loud, you know, that we have to keep reminding ourselves these are ancient keys. I mean, even the way he titled it is so brilliant, and I wouldn't want us to lose that along the way. Next week is our last class. And we'll be talking about magnetism. And Swamiji said over and over and over in many different ways in all of his books, in the end, it's all about magnetism. So I'm sure that's why he chose to end it there. It's very subtle in some ways what that means. But it's the essence of how to live and communicate and share on the path, so it should be a really a great week, I guess, like they've all been great weeks. But
it'll sort of nicely tie together everything as well. I mean, I've been trying to highlight throughout the weeks, you know, the little threads that, connect to all the other lessons, because they really all, everything feeds back. You could have, you know, this isn't a step one, step two, step three kind of thing. You could have done these in different orders because they all relate, which is worth remembering. You know, like, pay attention to all the ties to this. And also, if one thing is really hard to work on another, because they'll all help all the other aspects. And I think magnetism next week is like, they all feed into that, and it'll just be a glorious finale. But I think that is a good ending point for tonight. So thank you all. One more week.